There are ghost towns in the United States. There's probably ghost towns all over the world. Former boom towns, perhaps, or important settlements like the original Dogtown settlement was in Massachusetts on Cape Ann. But there's a, kind of a difference between a town that pops up, prospers, and then dies because, you know, the railroad moves or the agriculture of the area changed or they ran out of buffalo or there was no copper in those mines after all, whatever the reason. And when a town feels cursed, when people could stay but don't, and why it is that towns to the left and to the right of a community, they might prosper, but this one patch of ground seems to be responsible for more misery than joy. And that's what we'll talk about coming up. The book is called Death and Enchantment in a New England Ghost Town. Dogtown is the title of the book. And then I've been making sort of a list of other cursed towns, seemingly where the land will not support life, or at least not healthy life. And we'll talk about that and some of the similarities between Alyssa East's experience as she investigated Dogtown. Yes, it's true. Charles Ostman coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. He was on with George Norrie earlier in the week, and he's always fun and interesting. He's also in the After Dark newsletter with a great article, and I'm told I mentioned in it somewhere. I haven't seen it yet. But if you want to subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, easy to do that. Just go to the website at coasttocoastam.com. While you're there, I thought the photo of Bigfoot was still up. I say Bigfoot in air quotes here. That there's a story from about 250 miles north of me in Minnesota of supposedly of an image captured using a motion-activated camera in the woods. It doesn't work for me. I interviewed one of the people involved, though. Find them very sincere. I just don't think it's Bigfoot. So if you want to go take a look, you can go to coasttocoastam.com and then click onto my blog, and then the link to the photo will be there if you need it. And it all sorts out for you there with a handy interview from yesterday with one of the owners of the property. And you'll find out more about it on the website at coasttocoastam.com, where you can link up to Alyssa East, who comes up next. We'll find out the sad history of Dogtown next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Alyssa East's journey east is a personal one as well as a fascinating look back at a town that not many people know about, but is worthy of consideration for what it tells us both not about our national history, but also our personal history as well. The book is Dogtown, about this enchanted. It's a nice way of saying, I think, by the way, when you say the death and enchantment of a New England ghost town. The things that happen in Dogtown aren't always what we might call enchanting.
Right. Well, that's certainly true, Ian. And it's a question of, well, how do you define enchanting? And is it Dogtown that is enchanted, or does it enchant people who go there?
Right. But, you know, I think of enchanting somehow, maybe I'm just, you know, kind of in the fairy tale sense of something of a pumpkin turned into a coach. And some of the events in Dogtown are just really tragic. And I do think it's interesting that there's, you know, alleged witchcraft involved. And we'll talk more about that coming up. But also that there's a just kind of a sense maybe of how a town can die. And in a way, a town that had been once vital can experience death much like how human beings do, with the shutdown of one vital organ after another.
Right.
Until there's a certain point where it's almost a mercy killing just to stop the sadness of it. Let's go back to the earliest history of Dogtown. What the circumstances that formed Dogtown from the very beginning, in a way, might have set the path that it stayed on for the rest of its existence.
Right. Well, I certainly think that the beginning holds a lot of clues. Cape Ann was first settled in 1623 and really permanently settled in 1642. And at that time, it was covered in trees. There was a huge forest there. By 1700, all of those trees were gone. The earliest colonists at that time in that part of the country were Puritans, and they really believed that the wilderness was haunted, that the devil was in the wilderness, and that forest was menacing, it was evil. And so part of why there was such vigilance with clearing the land had to do with these religious beliefs, but also those trees that were stripped away fueled Cape Ann's first industry. And so unlike the boom towns that you're mentioning in your introduction,
right,
what gave Cape Ann its first boom was this forest, because even though Cape Ann, which is where Gloucester is located, is known for its fishing industry, its first industry was shipbuilding and lumber. A lot of Salem and Boston were built with wood from Cape Ann. But, you know, here was this giant bald spot, if you will. Dogtown is located in the geographical center of what is specifically the island tip of Cape Ann. So this is 25 miles northeast of Massachusetts. So you have this island that's about twice the size of Manhattan, and the center part of it is the remains of a Precambrian mountain. It's a highland. It's unlike the rest of that island in that, it's the highest point in elevation is about 150 feet above sea level. So it was already a little removed from the rest of the community, which was located on the shore.
The shore community, you might even argue, was going to benefit from a different kind of scenery. It was going to sort of connected to the ocean, and maybe right away the people of this area, which later becomes known as Dogtown, they started to suffer from isolation. Just the spookiness of looking out into the woods and hearing creatures moving around. In a way, the religious superstition aside, in a way, you can't blame them for being spooked out of the woods because,
well, yeah.
I mean, they were surrounded.
Well, certainly. And when you look at American history, the early settlers, we have this myth that we, you know, went out like the strong individual and the man with his family, and he, you know, plotted his stake and wrestled the landscape and under his submission. But actually, people were fairly communitarian, and villages were clustered together. You wanted your house to be next to someone else's house.
Right.
And you wanted to be on the thoroughfare. Another thing that's really interesting about Cape Ann is that most people traveled by boat. There were very few roads over land, and it was certainly considered much more pleasant to travel by water than over land.
Right.
To get to the village that became Dogtown, you would have to travel over some pretty miserable roads to get there.
And so what was the incentive? I mean, why plant a community there to begin with?
Well, that's the question that many people ask, and certainly I wondered that myself. And part of it had to do with, well, there's the folklore and then there's the history.
Right.
Folklore says one thing. The history, they don't quite match up, but they don't mismatch entirely.
Sometimes I don't know that there's a difference between folklore and history.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like a semantic difference between the stories that people tell and the stories that people write down.
Right. Well, particularly when you're talking about the earliest chapters of American history, when not everyone knew how to read and write, and there weren't many records that were taken. But the folklore is that people went to Dogtown, which at that time eventually became known as the Common Settlement, fleeing pirates and Indians. And this is widely accepted, but there is a problem in that there weren't any Indians on Cape Ann, but for a collective hallucination of Indians that happened in 1692, and that was the same year as the Salem witch trials. Gloucester is just up the road from Cape Ann. It's just up the road from Salem. Cape Ann was part of that witchcraft delusion, the witchcraft scare. In fact, there were 6 women on Cape Ann who were accused of witchcraft, along with the other 190 people in Salem.
You know, the whole witchcraft accusation were frequently innocent people were accused of having these evil powers, most often women, but not always. And sometimes it's because these women were the wisest women. These were the oldest, wisest women who lived slightly better than other people did, or were able to stay healthier than other people were able to do. And as a result, there was sort of the suspicion about them that they had some sort of secret power. And so there's that aspect of it that's just, you know, crazy and misplaced. But then there's something else, too. And I'm curious about this from the early settlers that you understand it. There's also some people that in that period would actually make the claim of being a witch because it had a power over other people. And it sort of was a way, a little bit like how the Rolling Stones stood up against the Beatles in the 60s by going kind of satanic. The Beatles were squeaky clean. The Rolling Stones were going to go satanic. It was sort of a way of separating oneself out. Was there any history at all of anybody that was making the claim, I am a witch, as opposed to people who were only just pointing the bony finger of blame and going, there's the witch over there?
Well, the witch question is fascinating, and it's also got a fairly complicated answer, in that there were not really university-trained doctors in this part of the country until I think it was the late 1700s. Most actually, preachers often were considered healers, and there were a lot of women who did have folk remedies and were called upon for their healing arts. This is fairly established and fairly common. And you know, part of the suspicion, the feminist critique of it, is that these women, you know, had a skill that once the university-trained doctors came in, those doctors didn't have. They had a knowledge that wasn't taught in a university. Certainly you see this today with alternative medicine, that certain illnesses will respond to an alternative treatment better than it will respond to a traditional Western medical approach. So you did have those women who were healers and were very proud of that, their skills.
You also have the placebo effect, which is interesting, and we see that from the modern pharmaceutical trials, that if you tell somebody this will heal you, and if you give somebody something to do, which seemingly activates their imagination that they will be healed from something, that, you know, sugar pills work to a remarkable degree in many of these trials. And we see that placebos do better than, say, these SSRIs, some of these antidepressants, compete to try to do as well as the placebos, where people seemingly get off their depression because they're essentially taking M&Ms. In some of those early medicinal beliefs, some of it is just the fact that somebody was doing something, anything to make me feel better might help me feel better anyway.
Sure. I mean, that can be said of any time period. You know, as for people who would claim to sort of claim a witch identity as an act of defiance or
right,
power, I certainly think that that could be plausible. And there are different moments when early Americans really believed in witchcraft. Certainly in the witchcraft delusion in 1692. I mean, Cotton Mather, who was sort of the voice of Puritanism, you know, he believed things that, such as King Philip's War, were sent by God to punish Puritans for the sin of wig wearing,
right?
And
which, you know, I still believe in. Still think that's totally legitimate.
Wig wearing is a sin. All right.
Think those guys walking around with all those wigs, that's what happens. That's why we don't wear wigs to this very day. That's why men just go bald. That's why, or we'll get another one of those on us.
Right. Well, certainly during wartime, people's belief in you know, superstition went up, and in 1742, this was wartime, and there was a woman named Peg Wesson, and she lived in Gloucester, and some soldiers went to see her before going off to fight in Louisburg up in Nova Scotia. She was considered a witch, and people did go see the town witch. They wanted sort of her blessing. It didn't go well.
Yeah.
So when they were up in Lewisburg and were having a very difficult time, they believed that Peg Wesson had cursed them. And so, you know, they and how this came to them was that there were crows that were following them and harassing them. And so the men, these soldiers, were taking shots at the crows each time they missed. And so finally, one of them plucked the silver button off of his coat and, you know, loaded into his weapon and fired it at the crow, hit it in its leg, and the crow fell from the sky immediately and died. When they returned to Gloucester after their battle, they learned that Peg Wesson had died of an injury to her leg. And when the doctor went and examined her, he found a silver bullet. This is an established old Gloucester tale. The official town history. It's widely repeated, and it's certainly a great story.
That's a wonderful story. But then it brings us back to that there was already a kind of pervasive psychology to the development in what would later become Dogtown. And we're talking with Alyssa East, the author of the book Dogtown, about this this enchanted New England ghost town. And the other way to look at it is cursed. And almost from the very beginning, maybe they were cursed. Perhaps they were cursing themselves by putting themselves in this place that it was sort of a kind of a no-win situation. They were going away from the communal area along the coast. They were going deeper into a forest. And then at the same time, they were completely suspicious of the forest that was around them. And so there were no Indians. There were no natives out there that were trying to bring them down. But they were imagining it. And the imagination of it is probably 10 times more potent than than if there had actually been a few Indians running around in the woods.
Certainly. And you know, another thing that gave this land an eerie cast is it's full of these giant boulders. Some of them are up to, I'd say, about 25 feet tall. They're pretty huge. They're glacial erratics. So they're the remnants of the Laurentide ice sheet. The Laurentide ice sheet once covered most of North America. And this was, you know, a continent-sized glacier, and many of these glacial erratics. The word erratic comes from the Latin root for it's the same word as a wanderer, but the way the ice sheet moved, it basically trapped these rocks, moved them there, and once the ice melted, abandoned them.
Well, that is a pretty good metaphor for how they. The original inhabitants may have felt about Dogtown, sort of abandoned out there in the woods. This is the blueprint for what will be happening more. We'll find out how this begins to play itself out as this town attempts to thrive and yet is doomed. And then I want to run past Alyssa East some of the other most famous sort of cursed pieces of land around the United States and look for some of the similarities in the story of the people of Dogtown. And we will hear more of the stories of the people that were there, the people that turned on each other, and even the very sad story of somebody who just even in the presence of Dogtown seemed to go mad. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, we're talking about this strange place called Dogtown. At the beginning, it wasn't known as that. It would come to be known as Dogtown. We'll tell you why as we continue to sort of unveil this forgotten piece of American history. It's a very interesting story. Alyssa East also goes into detail about how she comes across this story. Very interested in an artist that painted this area and how that drew her in to Dogtown. Lest you get too caught up in Dogtown, though, and never leave. I mean, it is an area with some sort of surprising twists and turns to it. And to this day, it's uninhabited, and probably for very good reasons. Death, and enchantment in a New England ghost town. More on Dogtown next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Continuing with the story of Dogtown. So we're talking about the mid-17th century when this area is settled out in Cape Ann in Massachusetts. But unlike the other communities like Gloucester or Salem, this one community kind of went deeper into the woods. And then it's a woods they started to harvest because they thought the woods were haunted anyway, and that they thought they were surrounded by these sort of imaginary Indian tribes that were coming to get them. And so it started sort of this town, the foundation of this town was kind of built on either dysfunction or outright paranoia. Wouldn't you say, Alyssa?
Certainly there's some of that to the history for sure. The paranoia was definitely part of what happened there early on. Dysfunction, there was some of that as well. People still, they're like, well, why did people go there? Well, I mentioned that the folklore says that people were fleeing pirates and Indians. There were some pirates, but they weren't really as much of, I would say, as much of a hazard as the folklore makes them out to be. And how people did end up going to this place, Dogtown, and settling it sort of stemmed on a land grant when the town was trying to encourage newcomers to work in the fishing industries. So, and similar to, the boomtown mindset, this workforce arrived, and some believe that they settled in Dogtown, which was really unwanted land. Turns out, actually, that the people who moved to Dogtown were some of the descendants of the earliest settlers there. They didn't last for long, and part of that was because of a dispute over where to sit in church. So
okay.
Dysfunction right. Certainly had something to do with it and had a lot to do with why the town was abandoned.
As we sort of, and then plus, now here we are in the later part of the 17th century where the Salem witch trials are already taking place. So we know that, there's sort of this, there's a mass hysteria just down the road anyway. There's a concern about witches and witchcraft. There's a belief in this, that there's this sort of enchanted force that's out there that could be working for them or against them. As we go into the early part of the 1700s, talk about how did Dogtown or the neighborhood that came to be known as Dogtown, did it thrive? Were these its best years in the early part of the 1700s?
Certainly, the first half of the 1700s is when Dogtown had its best years, but it was a really hard existence. The land is sort of like a carpet of rocks. In addition to the large glacial erratics that I mentioned, which the settlers actually believed were the remnants of Noah's flood,
sure, why not?
I think that they did probably give a funereal cast to the place. But the land was very, very hard to farm, and many people living up there were farmers or fishermen. The fishermen eventually just moved back to the coast. The farmers didn't do so well. Once the Revolutionary War came, the town lost even more population.
Why? I mean, for people that just went to go fight in the war?
Well, it turns out that a large number of Gloucester fishermen and sailors primarily became privateers. Privateering was a legalized form of pirating that dates back to the Middle Ages.
Sure.
And one of these privateer ships completely disappeared. It was a ship called the Gloucester, and it disappeared without a trace. This is fairly unusual. Many privateer ships during the Revolutionary War, there's some record of them. Either they show up on insurance lists for on the British side or on the American side, or there would be bits of wreckage that were reported. This ship was just completely, completely gone.
But so even if we, you could even make the argument in a way that that fits a similar pattern. I mean, the town is in trouble. The town is sort of it is kind of cursed in the sense that it already can't sustain itself based on the arable land that's nearby. People are leaving it. And then even the people that are from the town are after named after the town that's next door. That ship just disappears into thin air.
It did. And then not too long after that ship disappeared, there was a being called a corpuscent or St. Elmo's fire, which was this giant ball of light. And the corpuscent went from house to house of all of the widows who lost their husbands or women who lost their sons or their fathers on this ship. This is something that is another sort of amazing phenomena that is recorded in the town history. These balls of light were believed to be messengers from the other world, from the other side, that is, harbingers of death. Coleridge referred to these as witches' oils, and mariners saw corpuscents all the time. And so this added to the gloomy pall hanging over this place.
Are you referring to Samuel Coleridge, the romantic poet?
Yes.
Okay. So was he aware of Dogtown?
He was not aware of Dogtown, but he was aware of this phenomena of the corpuscent.
Okay, that's cool. I was just curious whether he was writing about that particular thing. And so in the town history, they experience St. Elmo's fire, which is, you know, it is otherworldly, even though it's this worldly. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see. And that it appeared to go from the rooftop to rooftop of the widows of men who were lost on the ship, the Gloucester.
That's correct.
Okay, and that got recorded officially in the history as opposed to folklore, where it's just, you know, something that somebody said. They actually wrote this down and said, this really happened on such and such a night, and here are the following people that witnessed it.
Well, their names aren't listed, but it's certainly in the town history. And this is another, you know, sort of point about the story, which is that there's no muster roll that exists for this ship. We don't know who exactly was on that ship, but we know that people from Dogtown, many of them became privateers. And though the communities all on Cape Ann lost very large populations during the war, for some reason Dogtown was considered to, you know, have taken the hardest hit. But other parts of Cape Ann lost more privateers and more soldiers than Dogtown did. But there was a tragic aura that was already hanging over this place.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And then that often becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Again,
yes.
We're talking about this book, Death and Enchantment in a New England Ghost Town, Dogtown. And we haven't even gotten to the full history yet of Dogtown. These are kind of still the early years of this cursed community. And so when we were talking about the witches earlier, has a curse already been offered yet to the town, or is there an explanation other than some of these socioeconomic explanations we've been giving on why Dogtown just seemed to be kind of a dog place to try and make a town?
Well, the witches, there was a population of alleged witches that lived in Dogtown after this time, after the Revolutionary War. And one of them was believed to curse anyone who tried to cross the land. And certainly years later, people said that she had cursed the place itself. You know, the question is, was this real or is this in jest? But her name was Tammy Younger, and Tammy Younger lived in Dogtown after the Revolutionary War. And in fact, it's not clear if some of the Revolutionary War widows who lived in this land were considered witches or if the witches were someone else. But after the Revolutionary War, the folklore holds that these widows lived up in Dogtown and they kept dogs for protection, and that is how the town got its name.
And it becomes like an official name too, not just something that people nicknamed it. Sort of, it becomes essentially the town's real name.
It did. The first official reference to the name Dogtown I saw, the earliest one, was in about 1819. And, you know, oftentimes a name is in common usage before it gets committed to print, certainly at that time when, you know, there still wasn't a lot of writing and recording of events on Kban, at least.
It's not like the internet where things are actually recorded before they even happen. I mean, it seems like, So these widows from the Revolutionary War period end up sort of protecting themselves by collecting lots of dogs, and they keep the dogs in the town, either keeping company or using them for protection. What were they protecting themselves from?
Well, who knows, Ian? That's just not really something that we can answer. I mean, they could have been protecting themselves, you know, from all manner of things. But that's just sort of the accepted line. But it turns out that this name, Dogtown, was used all across the country for a variety of types of communities. Most of them were populated by destitute people, and certainly those living in Gloucester's Dogtown, these widows were destitute. Their houses were falling down around them. There were also some former slaves who were living in Dogtown. It was just a very, very hard existence, but the name occurs in practically every state in the Union. At least it did in the 19th and early part of the 20th century. So destitute communities that were populated by women or minorities, Native Americans, and they tended to have, the name has a bit of a sinister cast. There are a couple stories that I came across of towns that were overwhelmed with packs of wild dogs, and that's how they got their name. And there's one town in Tennessee where people holed up and just shot at the dogs. They killed the dogs because the dogs were attacking them.
Well, okay, that's an interesting sidebar. And I want to get back to that because I think it actually speaks to some of these other cursed communities that I started reading about after I got a copy of your book this week. In the case of Dogtown, I want to throw another idea at you, that these women in this community that had lost lost its economic viability, these were people who were, you know, surviving at a level of poverty near famine. These were women who were now widows, some of whom lost their, you know, all of their families may have moved out. And I would argue that, and maybe I'm just being influenced by the show I'm watching these days on A&E, but I wonder whether they became hoarders, much like how people do today, where these women become slightly, and I'd say women more often than men, become slightly demented and start collecting every animal they can find. And it's sort of a way of compensating for the fact that they're totally isolated and that their families are no longer with them, or it's a way of rebuffing society that they, you know, they live in one of these houses that have 9,000 cats.
Exactly. Crazy cat ladies. I knew you were going to go there.
Well, I'm really serious, and I wonder whether that's true for Dogtown, that people start just collecting all these dogs, and it becomes part of the psychology of this community of hoarders.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think, too, that if you have lost everything, you do start to lose your mind a little bit. I mean, think about that. If, you know, you lost your entire family and your livelihood and you were scorned, but, you know, you have animals and you have a relationship with them. They're in your life because of whatever reason, either, you know, it's a true companionship or...
Right.
You're feeding them and they're just protecting you. 19th century attitudes about dogs were pretty different than they are today. Certainly people had animals for pets, but they also had them for workmanship, for guardianship. And And yes, this community was isolated. It was scorned. Some of these women were believed to brew dire drinks, and they had to make a living from whatever scraps they could find. Absolutely, it makes perfect sense that they would want some form of companionship.
Right, and it gave their life meaning to take care of these dogs, whereas life was, you know, was pretty much on the fringe otherwise. But so you mentioned the brews. So you have witches, people who are self-proclaimed witches, and you have people who are brewing potions and, in a way, sort of attracting one of the few aspects of commerce to the community from some of the from some of the other towns.
Well, you know, it's interesting because these women have sort of a range of occupations. Some of them were going down into downtown Gloucester and selling butter, or really you would have one woman who had a variety of occupations just to make ends meet. So she would sell butter, and this would be Tammy Younger, the woman who's credited with cursing anyone who tried to cross the land. Her house was right at the entrance to Dogtown, and each time an ox cart started to cross this bridge leading into Dogtown, she would yell out, and the carts would stop because they were afraid that she would curse them, and they would sort of leave her a tithing of pumpkins or fish or whatever they were carrying because they were completely afraid of Tammy Younger.
Right.
So Tammy was making butter. She was cursing people. She also, allegedly, opened her house to buccaneers, pirates, and all sorts of surly types, and was serving them rum. Other women were kind of had these no-tell motels, you could say, that they ran out of their houses. There's also been talk that these women were in fact prostitutes. That seems kind of unlikely because they did seem, sort of deranged and hard on the eyes, one could say.
Yeah, well, I don't know that back then. I've seen, you look at some of the prostitutes, for example, from the, sadly to say this, but from the Whitechapel murders, later known, as the victims of Jack the Ripper, and there weren't a lot of curvaceous, with it there doing prostitution. So maybe that was the standards had changed a bit, maybe. But
I think they probably have.
These weren't the women who were going to be going out with Tiger Woods, perhaps, but these are women, if you're in the woods, they just might do in that sense of that period. So But even there's Tammy Younger screaming out, "You can't cross this land unless you give me some sort of, unless you pay me, I will curse you," and that's the idea too. Is that where it takes hold that land is without the blessing of the witch to pass through it, you would be cursed. That something bad would happen to you if you crossed through that area.
Yes. Absolutely. All curses point to Tammy Younger.
Okay. And because that comes into play a little bit later on in the story of Dogtown. So now we're in this community has been not thriving, but subsisting for little over a century, maybe a century and a half at this point. We're coming into the mid 1800s and Dogtown will start to just fall apart completely. And we'll talk about that. The freed slaves that came to live in Dogtown due to its isolation and due to the unusual aspect of some of the people that are living there. And then we'll talk more about, like, for example, the last person to leave Dogtown, what happens to Dogtown, and then how some people to this day swear that there is something there in the ground. And I want Alyssa to tell the story that opens up the book, Death and Enchantment in a New England Ghost Town, Dogtown, coming up. Also, I've got a list of some of the other cursed communities in the United States, where it's not just a ghost town, but a doomed town. And we'll probably take a couple of those calls, too, about that in the last hour. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.